So we have now a panel discussion. I think we're going to deal with some of these matters, and Dwayne and colleagues are going to get up here. I think you're going to be leading and moderating this very exciting opportunity.
So good afternoon, everyone. If I could get the panelists to all grab a seat up here. I haven't had a chance to say hello to anybody except Sandra earlier today in another meeting, so hi, David. So this panel is going to talk about an issue that I think should be front and center for every one of us that works in this area of how we think about research and its translation to something that actually helps a patient get better or improves the quality of their life. And we've, year after year, we come together and we talk about some of these challenges that we refer to loosely as the valley of death. We have a great discovery, and it's ready to move, and the grant money's out, and it's too early for venture capital. It's too early to form a company. How that takes place, and in my day job at Connect, which I see dozens and dozens of these every year, the most frustrating thing to me is the more innovative the idea, the less likely it's going to be funded, because there's no pathway. There's no, it's novel, it's new, it's innovative. And everybody says, well, I wonder how the FDA will regulate this, or I wonder how you might get reimbursed for this. And there's no management team. And it's going to take a lot more work before I could actually invest. If they bring me a reformulated old drug, you know, that we can get funded because there's a pathway, it's been used in people. That's very troubling to me. So with that, and I don't have to go into great background with this group, but what I'd like the panelists to do, rather than the same old discussion around the problem, I think everybody understands the problem. What I'd like them to do, because I know each of them, I've spent time with each of them, I would like them to talk about their vision for how we solve this problem of taking these great scientific discoveries and translating those into products that can actually move forward. And I'm going to start with Carl because he's one of the very first people I talked to when I came over to Connect a number of years ago. I went to Seattle to see what he was doing. I haven't had an update in many years, but I am going to ask him to tell us about his experience. And then we're going to move down the line. I'm going to ask each one of them to just please share with us how we might move this whole thing forward. Carl.
Well, that's a great question. And I don't necessarily have the answer. I know that we have one answer in Seattle at Accelerator, which is something I've been running since 2003. And since 2003, we have put together 12 companies, and we've raised venture capital in 3 capital commitments. We're going to raise money again this year. And the idea at Accelerator is to identify, evaluate, fund, and then manage the very most exciting biotechnologies from anywhere in the world. And we bring them to Seattle. We put them in our space. Our management team manages them. So this idea of it doesn't have management is not relevant to us. In fact, management we view as a detraction. Usually early stage biotech business management is subpar and expensive, and we find we can do it better if we have one management team that is managing a lot of companies at the same time. We try to be as innovation agnostic as possible. We have done things that have been single asset protein molecules that are reformulations and better formulations of drugs, but we've also done things where an entrepreneur has walked into my office, grabbed a pen, went up to a whiteboard, and drew out an idea with no IP and no data and no publications and no nothing, and it was a great idea and we funded it. I think that people talk about the Valley of Death a lot and have been talking about it ever since before I started Accelerator. And what I think that the valley of death is that not everything gets funded, but really, truly great innovative ideas are getting funded. And there's just less venture capital chasing the same number of new and fantastic ideas than there was 10 years ago when we were in the dot-com bubble. And so it can be very frustrating if you think you have discovered something that's truly innovative and nobody's willing to fund it. I could spend an hour talking about how to solve that problem, how to look in the mirror a little bit at yourself, and how to look at your innovation a little bit and what the problems may be. But I think I'll leave it at that. The truly great ideas, I believe, are still being funded, and we're doing it at Accelerator, and I know of some other places that are doing it. I'm very excited that UCSD and the Moores Cancer Center has decided to be another place like us that is doing this.
So, Carl, what I particularly like about your model is your management team is handling multiple programs. You're not starting necessarily with, we're going to form a company with a full management team and incubate them. You're actually mentoring these ideas yourself, which is different, and I think that's novel. JT, you took over as chair of the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine. You probably have learned more than you cared to learn about some of the challenges in how to move these new exciting opportunities into the clinic. So talk a little bit about the programs that you're working on with industry and how you are approaching that.
Thanks, Dwayne. First of all, Carl, it would have been nice if the Wall Street Journal interviewed you in advance of that article earlier this week on the fact that biotech companies are further pulling away from investing in venture capital, fully investing in biotech stuff, and he would be a great example to the contrary. CIRM lives in the valley of death. That's why we were created. So we have sort of a lot of experience with how to try to move things from basic research into early translation to preclinical to clinical. And we spent a lot of time mulling over that idea. We started, as you know, earliest in our tenure in funding basic research. Then we moved into early translation, and we're now focusing sort of as a midway through our existence, at least in this funding cycle, in trying to figure out ways to more heavily weight projects that are in the later part of the continuum, but still in the valley of death. Which is a very difficult thing to tackle. We're very happy and fortunate to have the luxury of the funding to be able to do it. We've spent quite a bit of time talking to venture companies and big pharma to sort of try to ascertain what it is exactly that's going to hook them in. And one of the challenges we have is cell therapy is new. Cell therapy is a little scary. Cell therapy is yet to be proven in many instances. And as a result, this sort of reticence to get involved prior to proof of concept at the end of phase two is still there. Now, one of the things that is sort of an interesting thought is there, in addition to as we develop cell therapy, and we have some fantastic scientists here who are working with us, that we are most impressed with. See Katrina there, and she's doing wonderful work, et cetera. We're evaluating, in addition to the cell therapy approach, is there a way to get activation of stem cells through small molecules as another type of approach? And this, of course, comes directly into play in the cancer stem cell area. And the reason why is both a promising thing to look into in and of itself, but may be something that proves to be a very good way to get the money into the game is that pharma and venture guys understand small molecule. They don't understand cell therapy. So it's something that we're contemplating potentially to give a little more additional focus to really get these guys to understand that stem cells are a great thing to be involved in and to get them over this reluctance to buy into the cell therapy model. In terms of what we're doing to try to move things along, we put out $1.3 billion, of our $3 billion. We are in the projects that we have coming up, we are focusing more on later stage Valley of Death stuff. So you perhaps know about our Disease Team One Awards a couple years ago, which were focused sort of middle of the translational part of the spectrum. We have Disease Team 2 awards that are going to be evaluated in peer review next month, the applications. And those, by design, the RFA, were meant to be not midstream but further along in the preclinical stage. And we will, I think, get some very interesting later stage Valley of Death, if you will, projects coming out of that. The other thing we've got in an effort to try to encourage and foster more involvement of industry. We recently at the board approved something called our Strategic Partnership Program, which is meant to take projects that are sort of in midstream, and they can be early stage, mid-stage, later stage, whatever, but they need to be something that has sort of commercializable potential. And that can be evidenced by matching funds that the applicants are willing to put up from any variety of sources, whether it's through relationships they have with pharma or venture or government funding or disease foundations or whatever. If they can bring something to the table where they can match what they're looking for and they can prove to the peer review group that we have, as we do for all rounds of RFAs, that they are a project that we should invest in, if you will, then they will be funded. And they are, we're anticipating, even though we're saying it can be early, mid, later stage, that a number of these are going to come in somewhat later in that Valley of Death stretch. And so that's another way that we see to try to push things forward towards the clinic. We're also evaluating sort of external to CIRM possibilities about forming a venture philanthropy fund, which would basically look to fund specifically the most expensive part of the continuum, which is the IND through the end of phase two, and are busily putting together a presentation to take on the road to high net worth benefactors, healthcare foundations, et cetera. And that would be not just CIRM related projects, but would be aimed at regenerative medicine stem cell projects nationwide. And that would, if we can pull that off, and that's a big if, that would form another source of funds to get things moving along towards the end of the clinical trial process. So there are a lot of things on the table that we're looking at. We think that we're very, very optimistic that the research being done is going to lead to a lot of great things. Obviously, not everything leads to something. We all know that. But we think we're pursuing all sorts of avenues, and that a number of them will bear fruit. So. Anyway.
So thank you. So the Strategic Partnership Fund is really aimed at helping investigators that have things that are ready to go. If they can attract a partner, we'll put up their portion of the money.
Correct. That's their four-year awards. The RFA for that's going to be going out in May, I believe. So those of you who are involved in projects or companies, although academics certainly apply as well, keep an eye out for that, and if you meet the criteria involved, we would strongly encourage you to apply, because we're looking for the best and brightest ideas out there.
So thank you. Sandra, when I took this job, I had heard all kinds of things about the problem is really technology transfer, and I heard that often from faculty, occasionally from companies trying to license things. And when you took this over recently, I felt you had a totally different view of where you wanted to head this, and I'd like you to share a little bit about that with the audience.
Yeah, thank you, Duane. This is the second time today that Duane's coordinated a meeting that I've been in. I'm not quite sure if we're going to do this every day, but it's not a bad pattern. And delighted to have the opportunity to talk. I'm relatively new in my position. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Research here at UC San Diego. And as Duane said, coming into this situation, and not unlike many other places around the country, the model for technology transfer fit the economic system of a decade ago or two decades ago, not of the economic realities today. So what we are trying to do in the Office of Research Affairs at UC San Diego is to really have a new focus. And that focus is on building relationships with our industry partners. And there is no place where this is more true than between UCSD and the medical industry with regard to human therapeutics. We are both targeting the very same thing, the development of better treatment for our patients. And so instead of focusing on the technicalities, of course, there will be technicalities, in of each partner and their priorities, we are really focusing on the relationship. And we're moving more toward establishing commitments or master agreements with our industry partner, and then as a second stage to that, developing additional specific agreements. That two-stage process allows the industry partner and UC San Diego scientists to work together hand in hand, much as the CIT is going to have a new building structure. I think we have a new administrative structure for managing these research relationships. Now, that said, of course, we have to live within the confines of the UC-10 campus system, but many things that have been presumed to be rigid requirements are really guidelines. And part of what our office is doing is challenging some of the assumptions that have previously been made, so that we can have greater flexibility in our interactions with our partners. I could give you probably a dozen examples of situations just in the past 6 months where we have created agreements with our industry partners that were heretofore not seen in the UC system, and where our faculty are engaged in activities and industry is partnering with us hand in hand in ways that were not accomplished before. So we really see this as more of a relationship, and we need to build that relationship to the benefit of both the medical industry and UCSD. Now, that said, we have to have the structure to do that. And so in my office, we are developing a new division of Innovation and Industry Alliance. And this division will be focusing exclusively on the kinds of things we're talking about today. In the past, my perception is that we've been such successful scientists that we have pushed out our research, many to federal institutes and state and private institutes as well. But really, we're at a stage where we need to be more collaborative and have a pulling in component, that is, a welcoming component with our industry partner. And I think this new division will allow us to do that. As part of that, for example, by this summer, we will have an express license for therapeutics. And this will allow an industry partner and an investigator on campus, if they both agree, they'll be able to reach that agreement. We'll be able to get this agreement signed in less than a month. Currently, that takes on average 6 months. And some things can be done quickly, 3 months. 3 months is fast. Some things take a year and a half, as I understand it. But we will. Our goal is to have, for those individuals who choose to partner together in this process, to have that fully executed and in place within 1 month. And this morning I was meeting with some of our industry partners and faculty to review the express license proposal that we have before us. Additionally, We are trying to make more transparent the process of working with technology transfer. So our industry partners will be able to see where we're at in any material transfer agreement, any licensing agreement through an electronic process that the faculty can access and the industry partners can access. I think that will enhance our communication, help us identify where the holdups have been in the past, and to be able to move things forward in a much more efficient and satisfactory way. So those are just some things that are going on at UCSD that I hope will create a new environment and new processes that will make the sorts of things we've been discussing here easier to accomplish.
And I commend making this campus more user-friendly for industry so we don't fear getting into some dispute down the road about intellectual property or discoveries and trying to solve that problem up front with your standard MOUs, which are really turnkey and revolutionarily good. So, Dennis, you've been a highly decorated scientist. Now you're retiring, leaving this place in a lurch. And now, you also helped start a number of biotech companies. You've been through generations of this when venture capital was plentiful, when it dried up and became non-existent. And you've also had some vision about what we can do on this campus to help that. So share your thoughts.
Well, maybe I can give a perspective from 8 years at the Cancer Center. A decade ago, you know, Tom Kipps and I used to sit around and talk about what idiot oncologists were because all I did was ABC drugs without any targets, and companies thought they could be vertically integrated and take things right from the beginning to the end. Were very obnoxious. But the whole situation has changed and changed for the better. I think that the most exciting research in biology now is going on with cancer. The DNA is at the level now where everybody can use it, but the RNA world and protein world and the other world is very much beginning, and every patient is different. Nobody can be vertically integrated. So companies that don't work closely with academics who are doing the cutting-edge science and don't know how to stratify their patients and rapidly move agents forward with targets into selected populations are going to fail. So the CIT building, that Tom was talking about, was sort of set up to really take advantage of this. It is, now there's a need on both sides. So some things like the accelerator that Carl Weissman was talking about will provide the administrative assistance, and with the new Associate Vice Chancellor for Innovation Technology, to take naive scientists who talk to me a lot and get them to take their invention into something that's patentable and practical. On the other hand, the industry members of that building will provide services. They're much better at high-throughput screening, manufacturing, preclinical work. And we intend to incentivize them by providing access to all the cancer services, patients, outcomes, clinical care, library things at discounted rates using the more than 600 faculty that are here at the Moores Cancer Center. So I think in this kind of special environment with expertise of people like Carl and David Kabakoff advising on the private side, with providing incentives for industry, I hope to realize that if they don't work with us, that they're not going to succeed as each patient becomes more different from the next, that the situation will change.
Thank you. David? So you were originally involved in the company side, started some biotech companies, worked for some large companies, I think Lilly and some others in the past. Then you went over and became a venture capitalist. And my question for you is, why haven't you yet fixed the model so it works better? So talk about your thoughts.
Okay, so I guess Carl started with, it's a hard question. I guess maybe I should start with, I'm part of the problem. But maybe can offer a few comments. Just our fund is a $440 million fund. We'll look to invest in somewhere around 20 companies at around $20 million each. So we are not today looking at very early stage technology. But we might do out of the 20 investments in the fund, one or two preclinical, very exciting breakthrough science. So it's not like we're not doing them, but it's more on the 10% side. And I think that is part of the challenge, clearly. I guess I'll make a couple comments about some things that I have seen that have helped, if you will, technology transfer and technology translation. And perhaps some of these thoughts will be useful. Certainly on the company side, there are some sources of funds other than venture capital and other than NIH grants, and we do see companies taking advantage of them. There are grants from disease-specific foundation. There still are government sort of SBIR grants or government contracts. One of the things that the Burnham Institute, Sanford Burnham, has done recently is they have one building which is privately owned, and they have created some space there so that scientists from that institution can have, at a minimum, an address from which at which they can incorporate a corporate entity and for which they can apply for some grants. So, for example, with the new center that, you know, across the street, perhaps the university could consider leasing a portion of that space so that scientists from the Cancer Center, maybe other parts of the university, would have similarly an address. They could incorporate a company, and they could try to compete for other funds other than their academic funds. That might be a suggestion. The other is I've seen a few companies. It's tough, but I've seen a few companies in this community start totally on government grants, advance science to a certain point before they're able to attract venture capital. I chair a company, Trius Therapeutics, that was started with a $3.6 million grant from the NIAID, and they worked and developed for 3 years, a half dozen people, before they attracted venture capital. David Campbell presented earlier a company that does have venture capital but just was awarded a new grant called the Trend Grant, which is a new program from the NIH for funding rare disease programs. I guess I forget the acronym for TREND, but it's basically to fund rare diseases. So I think there are some sources that one should explore, and perhaps the university can help facilitate some of this through, for example, a new facility. Maybe a couple other comments, and I guess I always have had the view that the best technology transfer comes when you actually transfer people that have experience and knowledge, and that may be a little bit provocative or controversial, but some years ago we started a company together, and one of the assistant professor researchers from UCSD who had worked with Dennis for many years, put up his hand and said, "I'm going to take a sabbatical. I'm going to come help start up the laboratory and the company." I don't think he ever came back. But seriously, that was a very, very important step. It actually gave investors confidence that, you know, there was going to be some human continuity, transfer of knowledge, transfer of technology. Because at the end of the day, one of the issues that we as investors look at is science, technology, commercial opportunity, but we usually look as much and maybe more to the people and the people that you invest in and their willingness and their commitment and their expertise. So I'll make that comment. And then stimulated by something that Sandra Brown said, having negotiated license agreements with the University of California with multiple campuses, I'm delighted to hear that there have been and are improvements in process. But I think process is only a piece of it, and the other is content. And so, again, maybe a little provocative, I know that university funds are somewhat limited for filing patents. I think there should be more attention to fewer things filed of better quality. I think there should be attention in certain cases to not filing quite so fast, but filing more substantive, better content. Always challenges because of first to file. But you know, filing on the day before a publication appears, and you know, the university loses an enormous amount of value. We, as stakeholders in the university, lose an enormous amount of value. And I, looking at the IP, we started a company here locally with IP out of the University of California, San Francisco, and had to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in improving the quality of the IP that we licensed from the University of California. So I think, you know, the content piece is important. So maybe I'll stop with some of those, hopefully, constructive suggestions.
Upbeat ideas. So I want to just talk a little bit about pharma and get your reactions, those of you that care to address that. But pharma is going through what I call the race to the bottom. They are cutting their internal research about as fast as they can. And they're going to keep certain parts of it, but the goal is to get it down to maybe 50 internal and 50 external, maybe even lower than that. And there are, I'm sure, pharma companies in here that can talk about it. But it is changing. And the reason it's changing is it hasn't been particularly productive. Their licensing strategies and their acquisitions have largely fueled their pipelines. I remember when Merck said they would never license anything. They are licensing more than half of their sales today are licensed ideas. The other thing that I see them doing is getting much closer to the research institutes. And Pfizer, again, perhaps leading the way, but you had Janssen Pharmaceutical 3 weeks ago. We dedicated their new incubator. We dedicated a new incubator last week at San Diego State, the Shiley Bioscience Incubator. Last week, or the week before, it was announced that Merck will build a $90 million sort of incubator here, but all aimed at the same thing, because the fear is that we're not starting companies at the rate we did, where we could do a couple rounds of venture, and then we had this magical thing called the IPO, the fact that we could move the risk to the public. And when that went away for pre-revenue companies, and I think it's never coming back, it's really changed everything. And I think we're all now beginning to realize that we're going to have to take matters into our own hands, and that, and this is really the question. All of you, I think, recognize how important place is to these relationships we're talking about, where there's this continuous interaction between the research community, the venture community, the corporate community. And I'd like each of you, if you care to comment on that, talk about San Diego and its role there. So maybe, Sandra, maybe you want to kick off.
Well, San Diego is, I think, an underappreciated location for this arena. There are other parts of the country that get a lot more credit and attention for less work and less success than we have here. If you were to just look in, say, the last 4 years at UCSD, we have 70 startups in therapeutics and diagnostic devices, 70, and 30 startup companies in this area as well. So I think San Diego is one of those unique locations where not only are we talking about, and we've heard, we just heard a great example from the CIRM, not only are we talking about University of California, San Diego, and San Diego State University, but we're also talking about our partners on the Mesa. So we are really in all in this together, and we will succeed to a greater extent if we pay attention to the strengths that each of these institutions can bring to a collaborative effort.
So, Carl, you have the place all to yourself up in the Northwest. Talk about the interaction there versus some of the other places you go.
So I spend an awful lot of time trying to convince people that Seattle is a more important biotech hub than San Diego. So
You can go now.
So I won't spend time doing that today, but I can say that we spend a lot of time looking around the world, primarily in underserved biotech hubs. So we look in San Diego. We spend a lot of time at Caltech. We look in Research Triangle Park. We look at places primarily where there's fantastic science happening and not much venture capital happening. And we do it for a very selfish reason. When demand is low, prices are low. And we think there's great science happening in a lot of places where we can make investments at very low prices and have incredible things come out of them. We move everything that we do up to Seattle. So we're not per se helping you guys out a whole lot. But if this CIT gets off the ground and it's backed by venture capitalists, you guys could be robbing my backyard pretty soon as well. On the notion of pharma and research, I'm going to try and be just a little bit less provocative than David here. But I think that pharma has no business being in research anymore. I think that the least efficient place to do research for industrial purposes, even less efficient than an academic institution where there are academic pursuits, rightly so, that are served, is in a huge, monolithic, dinosaur-like pharma company. They are fantastic marketers. They understand how to do clinical research. They understand how to manufacture things. But in terms of agile innovation, it's not there anymore. It's being done in small companies, and it's being acquired by pharma. And I think it's the right placement of capital to do that. And so it doesn't make pharma companies very happy when I say this, but I believe with all my heart that small, innovative biotech is where research should be done, and large, monolithic pharma is where clinical and marketing and sales should happen.
So it's an interesting comment. I have my own biases here, but we wrote a paper, my colleague and I, Pedro Cuatrecasas, and we described what Carl just talked about, but Pedro had such insight into what went wrong. And his comment was that in the 70s, Big Pharma brought in these management techniques used by large industry, management by objectives, quarterly reviews, matrices. And while it worked really well in certain aspects of their companies, it was a disaster in research because guys like me, product managers, got all the control. So we'd sit in those research meetings and kill everything. All we wanted is to have a product that would be competitive with Merck's because we're getting killed and can't make our numbers. And so the frustration that built up out of that system, quarterly reviews where people were competing against each other because there's only one decision maker. And he said that the other problem was that the CEOs of these companies who were formerly scientists and engineers became business people. That's what we moved to. So you think about that, and you think about the productivity of a company like Genentech. Who do you think was the product manager for Avastin? Two failed phase three clinical trials, VEGF, and Art Levinson stood up and said, I think there's a drug here, and we're going to do it over. And everybody sort of took a deep breath and said, is the guy crazy? And he was able to keep that going. I think Ray Vagelos was able to do that at Merck. And if you think about it, and even in other industries, who do you think was the product manager for the iPad or the iPhone? Steve Jobs. We lost that. And we said, now we can manage this stuff. And I think that was one of the big breaking things. John.
So I'm going to not quite address the San Diego issue as being a Los Angeles person myself. But on the general subject matter of pharma and research, there was an article I'm sure many of you saw in Forbes a number of months ago, which talked about the shift in paradigm of the research function at many of the large pharma shops, not all of them because they haven't all bought into this, but this notion that they shouldn't be involved in R&D and should, in fact, farm that out, whether it's to small companies, as you were saying, or to the academic institutions that later form the core of what becomes small companies. I do think that they are very much in that mindset and will only get more so as you go along. So they're looking for strategic alliances with small companies, with academic scientists, trying to find the real nuggets out there and to fund some of this research contracted out to these guys, which provides both a win for the small guys who are in the valley of death and also gives sort of a first look for the big pharma at what's coming up through the ranks. We had actually convened a meeting at CIRM on this very topic where we brought in a couple people to discuss this. Actually, there are about four or five thought leaders on the subject and how we go about with particular interest in what our scientists are doing, how we get them and the pharma guys to try to bridge this gap, knowing that we have this sort of skepticism about cell therapy, as I mentioned earlier. And it was a very interesting discussion, a lot of good points put on the table. And I will say we are now beginning to hear from some of the big pharma companies who actually have an interest in exploring potential strategic alliance with some of our funded groups. And so I think you're going to see that as a trend that starts to develop, because it's all about pipeline for these guys. And if they can't identify where the next product's coming from and try to get an inroad into it, they're going to be progressively more and more in trouble.
So, Dennis, the culture of the Mesa, you've been here a long time. How do you view it in the relationships with the other? That just there are 82 research institutions now, and 80 of which are here on the Torrey Pines Mesa, two-thirds which are on this campus. And they keep coming, as I said. We've got five new ones in the last 24 months and a couple more in the works.
I'm glad to see the university administration moving forward so positively with these new changes, because San Diego obviously is a wonderful location and a tremendous workforce, and being on the Pacific Rim, we've had it easy, I think, in developing technology. But there's a lot of competition around the world now, and California is not such a pleasant place to run a business. So we have to be constantly on the guard and make this a top-notch place, an efficient place to develop new products. And I think this, the Cancer Center here and the Science Park and what's going on, the university as a whole and the other institutions on the Mesa is part of that. But now's not the time to sit back and say we're doing a good job, but we need to be constantly pushing forward as times change. And we need to have advisors from the public and private sector at all times, making sure that we're not doing poor projects. If we do that, I think then we will remain competitive.
David? I'm going to open it up after this. So if you have questions, be thinking about it.
So clearly this community has evolved over the years. When I came back to San Diego the second time, it's the first time I was a postdoc in the mid-70s, first nude mouse facility, you know, out in a trailer not far from here, et cetera. But, you know, the community has grown. Obviously, the growth of research institutes is terrific. Also, the proliferation of companies. I'll just share a story that from last week. I was in New York meeting with a banker who is representing Roche in the attempt to acquire Illumina. And he said to me, gee, if I come to San Diego, will I be persona non grata? And, you know, how do people feel about that? And I said, you know, I think if Roche acquires Illumina, it will be one of the next great things that will fuel the growth and development of industry in San Diego. So if you go back, once upon a time, there was a company called Hybertech. It was acquired by Eli Lilly. And we had Agron, was acquired by Warner Lambert, by Pfizer. And then IDEC acquired Biogen, or Biogen acquired IDEC, and Elan acquired Dura. And every one of these events created enormous opportunities, talent, people seeking new opportunities, seeking to do new things. And so the community has grown, and I think meetings like this bring folks together from different institutions across the community, and there's a lot of talent here. We don't necessarily have to, you know, recruit as aggressively to bring people into town. And so I think as the industry grows, there will be more and more talent to help scientists in the university, in the research communities, figure out what to do with new inventions, figure out how to translate them. I think that's pretty exciting.
Audience questions? So, yes, back row. Hi. So another way of saying that, somebody said this, I think, at TEDMED last year, but what's happened in this industry is the inverse of Moore's Law. Moore's Law, where you half the price, double the capacity, double the amount of products for decades now. We have the opposite going on. Taste costs twice as much, takes twice as long, and we get half the number of drugs. That is not sustainable. And there are many, many reasons for that, but one of them particularly that Kerry is mentioning is the regulatory process has not gotten easier, and it's an inherent problem. We spoke about this at the meeting last year about the fact that the FDA is biased, and we would be if we worked for the FDA towards the safety aspects. The companies see all the good things they can do and can't understand why you can't see that risk and benefit, when in truth, the only people that can see risk and benefit are the people that own the disease. It's not the FDA's disease. It's not the company's disease, not the university's disease, the patients. And until they step into that void, I don't think we're going to change. And that's exactly what's going on. So we have prescription drug user fees. We have all of these things. So comments, John.
You know, there was a very interesting speech that Andy Grove gave at the World Stem Cell Conference in October where he was identifying exactly the problem you're talking about. And he said, you know, what the FDA really needs is a completely radical transformation where what they should be concerned about first and foremost is safety, toxicity, et cetera. And once you've established that, then you should leave it up to the companies to bring in patients who are willing to be the subject of trials that they would have to establish efficacy, et cetera, and greatly streamline the process of establishing whether something works or not once you know it's safe. And, of course, that's kind of anathema to the whole FDA structure and way of things have always been done. But it was a provocative speech. Sounds like that'll never happen. Well, it's interesting because there's an association in the regenerative medicine space called the Alliance for Regenerative Medicine, ARM. Many of you may know about this, but they're actually involved in discussions with the White House as we speak, recommending some sort of overhaul that's directly along those lines. Now, that's one group that's trying. Others will try, probably won't get anywhere. But if you start to try to develop a whole different way of thinking of how things can be handled, you can address this issue that it's taking longer and longer, and you're not getting the results.
Other questions? Go ahead, Dave.
I just want to make a comment, partly in response to Carrie's question. So, I think that right now there is legislation pending in Congress to implement new regulatory paradigms for quotes drugs for special populations. And I think one of the things we heard about through the course of today is, you know, the molecular basis of defining special populations. And I think it's, you know, we can sit here and talk about things we can control. We certainly can't control Congress and FDA, but we certainly can be part of creating a body of science that said this drug is for this population. And while, and Dave Cherish has left, while, you know, we can ask the question of why did it take 17 or why will it take 17 years for selinjetide, the Pfizer ALK inhibitor went from discovery of the genetic mutation to market in, what, 5 years, Kitty? So I think there is hope if you can precisely define patient populations based on science. I think regulatory science ultimately can be built around that. But the approach of trying to take a drug that is not necessarily where the mechanism of action is not necessarily fully understood, and there are plenty of those drugs that are on the market, and plenty of our companies have tried to develop drugs where we didn't understand how they worked. And so I think there is a need for a much higher level of rigor and discipline in science, both, you know, on the research and development side and on the regulatory science side. And, you know, I think back to some projects I've been involved in that have been successful and others where, you know, you sit back and say, why do we take that drug into the clinic? So I think it's incumbent on us, and maybe to the theme that you heard from Carl, not everything deserves to go forward. So I think there is some reason for hope both on the political front and the science front.
So a question down here. I get to you.
You've actually had 12 companies or so start up over the last 9 years. What sort of things in your accelerator facility have you found to be most important and most effective in making this work, and what sort of things you find least effective? I mean, if you had to do it all over again to make your building as more and your facility and your operations most effective.
Is our relationship with the Institute for Systems Biology. And it's a relationship where most people look at it and say, oh, they're just taking technology out of the ISB and investing in it, and that's the relationship. But actually it's completely inverse. We view the ISB as a resource and their faculty and staff as great consultants and advisors in the identification and evaluation and then development of our companies. And we have access to all the excess capacity in their core facilities, which means that our little teeny startup companies don't have to buy $750,000 mass specs and then try and lure a world expert operator of such a machine to come work for them. We can get in a car and drive 5 minutes and hand a sample to the proteomics core at the ISB and get data back within a day or two. So I would encourage UCSD and the Moore Center to think of anything that they can do to facilitate that kind of a relationship with this new CIT, and to think about what's special about UCSD and the Moore Center that companies can't access elsewhere. And one of the things that has come up already in discussion today, which I knew would be a huge asset here, is patients, data and samples and outcomes. And in almost every company that we've ever started, getting access to real primary tissue samples and data is the most expensive, most time-consuming, and most difficult thing that we do. And you guys already have that here. And if you can work out a way to make that seamless and simple and have some sort of a master agreement like you were talking about for doing that, you will have solved huge problems. The single least effective thing is constraint. And when I say constraint, what I mean is parochialism. We're only going to invest in things out of our university. Our university investigators are going to be favored. We're only going to invest in things from San Diego. We're only going to invest in things from California. We're only going to invest in things that look like this sort of a company. And we go into looking at an idea or an opportunity. It could be from Estonia. It could be from Pakistan. It could be from anywhere in the world. And it can be from a world-recognized, already decorated researcher, or it could be from a postdoc in a little teeny lab that no one's ever heard of. But all we care about is the quality of the idea. And it can be, doesn't have to be cancer, doesn't have to be immunology, doesn't have to be, it's not constrained. And as soon as you take the blinders off and you don't constrain yourself artificially, then you open up a world of better opportunity.
So we'll take one more question. Yes.
Small clinical trial. But the, what was empowering that was using the CF Foundation to identify patients. It was really the patient access and the development, I think, of the investigator network that provided that those patients to Vertex, and that association between the CF Foundation, the investigator network, and Vertex that made that whole effort so incredibly successful and so incredibly fast. And the FDA was able to buy into that because it was so targeted and so accurate and so precise. And I think if you could do the same thing in oncology or other areas, it would work just as well.
Yeah, the thing that is very interesting in addition to what you just said was the funding provided by CFF, which is sort of a new paradigm also, disease foundations being the ones actually funding the research, which is another way of bridging that valley of death and another source of potential investment.
So we're going to thank our panel in a minute, but just to sum up, the scientific innovation that I'm sure you heard today is compelling. It offers hope, and there's so many opportunities. But that in itself, without innovation around the financing model, around the regulatory challenges, and around the reimbursement for these products, the great science will not reach the people who need it. So I think it's the panel, it's people like you that have to continually think about this day and night, not just a narrow area. You got to think about the whole continuum. So thank the panel. It was wonderful having you here.